Welcome to Transformative Talk, Critical Conversations for Teachers. I'm Dr. Zid Haddad, a professor of instruction within the Department of Interdisciplinary Learning and Teaching at the University of Texas at San Antonio. I teach undergraduate and graduate courses in curriculum and instruction. In short, I teach teachers how to teach and save lives through the use of critical multicultural education as an approach to teaching and learning. Our podcast is produced by a different group of graduate students each week, giving them an opportunity to talk about what they're reading in my class, what they experience in the field, and how that impacts their own lives and understandings. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to our podcast from wherever you're listening. Also, you can ask us questions and engage with us further using the anchor.fm website or the anchor.fm app on your phone. You can submit questions and you can also send us voice messages. And remember, please share our podcast on all your socials so that we can build our audience. Thanks for listening, and here's today's episode.
Hello, everybody. This is Blanca, Bruna, and Laura, your hosts for this episode of Transformative Talk. In this episode, entitled Beyond Academic Performance, Sociocultural and Sociopolitical Consciousness for a Just Education, we'll talk about the role of culture in academic performance and what is justice in education and why do we need it?
Hi, and we want to talk about a great educator and social justice advocate from here, from the United States, Gloria Laxon Billings. And we have a quote here. Blanca, would you like to read that quote?
Yes, it's actually from her article from 1995. If you happen to have the article, where the page we're quoting from is 159. Educators traditionally have attempted to insert culture into the education instead of inserting education into the culture.
Yeah. What do you think about that? That you have the interesting perspective from Brazil.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that for starters, we need to think about what culture is and what we understand when we talk about it. So this is something that I've been thinking of. When we say Brazil, we think about something, right? And when we say Colombia, Mexico, or what do we think when we say Brazil? What do we think about when we say Colombia? So Brazil, I can say like soccer, Brazilian football, and Pelé, Neymar, Samba, something like that.
Samba is a big one, yeah.
Something like that. So I would first think what we are talking about when we are talking about culture, and then what we are talking about when we are talking about inserting it into education instead of inserting education into culture. Why? Because even though there is this attempt, I think most often than not, this culture that is being inserted into education, it misleads people in a way.
It's interesting that you say that because in case you ladies don't know, this is the month from September 15 to October 15, where in the United States, we celebrate Hispanic Heritage Month, which now many people call Latinx Month, right? Just to be appropriate to and respectful of everyone's cultures. However, I think that's a really good reflection of the way people see cultural anything, because it's very superficial a lot of times. When you ask someone, how do you celebrate Hispanic Heritage Month, if they even know what it is, they'll say very superficial answers. Even if you ask students, what is your culture? They're not really sure how to answer that question. So that's a very good point that you bring up, Bruna.
Yeah, and growing up in Colombia, we never reflect about several cultures. It's like we have to learn what teachers were saying at school, and we have to take that as a truth. And growing up, I have been doing that reflection that it's not one culture, they're cultures. And even in the same country, we are most of the time ignoring minoritized groups. Like in Colombia, we're indigenous people. They're absent in the schools. We're not really honoring those backgrounds in Colombia, I would say.
Oh, yeah. And see, this quote that we started with, it actually talks about Indian children experiencing difficulties in school. And the author thinks it is related to this attempt of inserting culture into education instead of the other way around. So this brings me to another topic about the indigenous kids. See, minoritized communities, they can actually relate to each other. Although, of course, we are all different and we have very nuanced experiences. But since we are all minoritized in this way, we can relate. You know, we are describing pretty much the same problem. And you mentioned like indigenous people in Colombia, and we do, of course, have them in Brazil, but we also have them in Australia and in African countries, but we don't consider them like indigenous. What we are considering, it's probably like Native North American when we talk about that. And we have multiple indigenous cultures as well.
Because our podcast has been very famous. Lately, we have been receiving some letters from educators here from United States. And one of the participants said, a lot of time, sometimes as teachers, we think that we are being culturally responsive or culturally relevant, but we are really just doing additive culture curriculum. This is a massive pitfall that educators have a tendency to get trapped in. It is basically the idea of adding culture into education rather than making culture and education intertwine with one another. I think this is something that is important to consider in practice. This is the idea of one active educator. Now, what do you think about this?
What do you think about it, Blanca, as a teacher yourself? What do you think about this additive culture curriculum?
Well, as a current educator, I realize that this is very true. Right now, I was just talking about how there's a focus on Hispanic culture this month, not by all teachers, but because it is the month of its recognition, a lot of people have it in their forefront. But there's also African-American Black History Month in February. And that's when you pull those books out to read. It's not already part of our curriculum. So when teachers do these type of, this month is Hispanic Heritage Month, so let me pull out a book that's about a Hispanic person. Let's learn about people in the Hispanic community just this month. Or when it's Black History Month, let's read about Martin Luther King just this month. It's not something that's continuous, and it's not something that comes from the top down. If I would even argue that a lot of times our curriculum does not reflect culture. I mean, it does reflect the mainstream culture, but all of our minority students are being left out. And I think that these teachers have all the best intentions. And it's not a bad thing trying to find things that our students relate to. And I myself do the same thing, look for books that they see themselves reflected in, look for activities that they have background knowledge in, or their families or their communities. But because it's not part of the curriculum, they're having to add it themselves. And I would say that it's even a good practice because we want to reflect our students' culture and experiences and what we do in the classroom. But the problem comes when not everybody is doing it.
Yeah, I had been observing some early childhood classrooms, and we had the centers. And you're going to see posters that portray people from different cultures. You have like in the kitchen area, the dramatic center area, you have foods like tacos. It's like the only diverse food that they have there. And you had pizza, that kind of stuff. But teachers, they don't really have time to be intentional, because when you have young children, they are just cleaning, like changing diapers and paying attention that they're not going to bite each other. And sometimes it's not a matter that they don't really care, it's that they're really busy. And I think we as researchers, we need to find ways to really support them, because sometimes they don't have the time to be intentional. They require more time, and we are not allowing educators to have that time in the educational system.
Laura, I think this resonates a lot with another opinion that we have from an educator who actually works with teacher training, so forming our new educators. And she says that at some point, at the end of a class focused on culturally relevant pedagogy, one of her students asked if they really had to do the activity, if they really had to focus on culturally relevant pedagogy, or if it was just one of those extra things on teachers' plates.
I think right now that resonates with a lot of educators who are feeling very overwhelmed and under-supported. They do have a lot of things on their plates, and being culturally relevant or culturally sustaining does imply getting to know your every single one of your students on a personal level and their families and communities, and then looking for resources that are not available on campus. This outcry from the educator, I would say, is common. It is an issue that, like Laura said, that's what we're trying to get to an answer for. That's what we're trying to find support for all educators, so that it doesn't seem like it's something more that they have to do on their already long list of things to do.
Yeah, maybe if we, through research, we can find ways in which they can integrate this culturally relevant contents and experiences in their classroom, but not like doing more because our educators are really overwhelmed.
I actually created a grant or wrote a grant a couple years ago, and I created culturally relevant inquiry kits so that all that teachers had to do was go check them out and use them however they saw fit in their classrooms. However, even with the resources right down the hall, there was still so much curriculum that they had to cover that not a single person checked anything out in those 2 years before I left that school. So even with the resources, I think we need to move towards having it as part of the curriculum to begin with, because otherwise it will be something extra, regardless of whether or not they have the resources. It will be something extra that either teachers are going to find time for or have to buy time from something else, or that they're going to have to find a way to integrate it into their curriculum, find a way to teach what they have to teach anyways using those materials.
Yeah, we have an idea here from another educator. She said, I feel like this is still true among many educators. They receive the curriculum lesson planning aspect and they do try to implement the culture into it. But let's say that 99% of your students' population is mainly Hispanic. How do you celebrate the other 1% of culture without having them feel as though they're singled out? What do you think about this? If you have 99% of the students from one culture, how do you celebrate the other 1% of the minoritized group that you have?
I'll say this, and this is probably an unpopular opinion. I really appreciate this question. And of course, this is something that I tend to question myself about as well. But I'd like to problematize this a little bit. When our classrooms, they were 99% white, no one was really asking about this. What we were doing to not single out that minority that were there and that, you know, in that environment that would be a minority, that person, that kid, we weren't really talking about this for a long time. And now that, you know, the minoritized communities, they are actually being heard a little bit more, we start to question, hey, but what about everybody else? But again, I really appreciate this. And this is something that I question myself about. I think that we cannot single anyone out. We cannot neglect the students because they might be part of a dominant oppressive culture without even realizing it. If we are talking about like K-12 education, sometimes that kid, that teenager has no idea of what is really going on and what does it mean to be part of an oppressive group. So we need to be careful to not, let's say, to not mix up the macro, you know, problem and situation to the individual, do not, you know, not mixing up things like, oh, this kid is white, therefore this kid is clearly racist. So I don't think this is what happens.
I think it's important to keep in mind that statistically, the United States is moving towards being majority minority. I think the year 2040, it's when right now we're projected, if not sooner, that the majority will be minorities. So at some point we have to realize that we need to incorporate all minorities and even the majority, who will then now be the minority, into everything that we do. Like that's a good point. Like, what if you have one kid that's of a different culture? Then we do everything we can to make sure that we address and we respect everyone's culture, regardless of which one it is. Right now I have a classroom that where I have most of my students, I would say about 70% are originally from Mexico. I would say another 25, wait, let me make sure I do the math correctly, that adds up to 100, but the next majority would be from Honduras. I have one child who's from Nicaragua, and I don't want him to feel left out. I don't want him to feel like his culture is less than just because he's the only one. Of course, he's also from a minority. And like we said before, that in itself makes us all have something in common. But when you're the one, what if I had someone who is from an African-American culture or a white Anglo culture in a dual language classroom? That does happen, where you have a little bit of minority and majority. And I've had that happen in the past. Then we make sure that we incorporate everyone as much as possible. But then we don't want to take that lens away from our minorities, because our curriculum by default reflects that of the majority. So I think that's also something we need to keep in mind.
And this is something that is happening in doctoral programs as well. I've been reflecting about our program and the authors that we're studying, they're mainly from Europe or from the United States. Mm-hmm. I think from Brazil, we just had Freire, and from Colombia, we had none. Yeah. Colombian graduate student, I don't have a connection with the authors in Colombia that are doing culturally relevant pedagogy, not because we don't have, it's because our program is not integrating those voices. So maybe for me, as an international student, could be something that I can give to the program, because we are not listening to all voices either.
Right. And you know what? You saying that just made me think even of our classroom, the class that we're currently in. Sometimes it can get uncomfortable when you have few of the majority that are outnumbered by the minority. And that's where communication is so important, when an open dialogue and open mind is so important, because we don't ever want to single anyone out or make anyone feel uncomfortable, which I think could happen if you don't have the correct dialogue happening in a classroom.
Yeah.
Even as adults right now.
Quick example, I think, might illustrate this. So in Brazil, the majority of the country, and I'll talk about religion, but I strongly believe that religion is a major part of culture. Even though not having a religion, it plays as a cultural element as well. So the majority of the Brazilian population is Christian, either Catholic or from some derived Protestant church. And my family is not. Less of us, we are not Christians. And here's the thing. In the part of the country that I'm from, my religion and similar religions, they are derived from African religions. And they are treated as something really bad. Of course, it comes from Africa. No one wants that, right? So they're treated as inferior, but lots of the times they're treated as something coming from Satan.
Yeah.
So it's not just, it's not worth it, but it is the, you know, the extreme opposite to what they believe in. And this is not true. But here's the thing. What do we do when we have, like, for example, different religions in a cultural way, in a cultural approach? Why I'm saying this? Actually, this weekend and tomorrow, we have something that's similar to Halloween in terms of what we do, like giving candies and so on. And this comes from a tradition from those religions that are not Christian. So we give away candy. That's what we do. Lots of times what happens that a family that does not partake this religion and that is Christian or any other religion will tell the kid not to take it because it is from Satan. And it's not something like this person that is giving out candy believes in something different. We do not believe in the same thing, but they can, whatever, they think it's right. And we just believe in something else. And this relates to the communication part. So how do we communicate this? How do we communicate with oppressed and oppressors, white, Hispanic, Black people, without really pushing any extra prejudice on top of it?
That's you know, it's funny you say that. It reminded me just this week, speaking of Halloween too. I don't celebrate Halloween, but of course I have students that do. And a little girl, one of my little girls goes, I don't celebrate Halloween. I was like, that's okay. Everybody celebrates different things. And she goes, oh, it's because it's from Satan. My mom told me it's from Satan. And then another little girl speaks up. Oh, yes. My mom said it's from Satan, too. And I think we have to model these behaviors, right? What we expect from our students to do. And I had a conversation. I was like, different people believe different things. And we have to be respectful. And we have to remember that just because we think something doesn't mean that everybody thinks the same way. And I'm talking about 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, yeah. 7-8-year-olds. Sometimes those conversations need to take place, I think, even with adults. Because that what you just said reminded me of that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for this great conversation. Now we need to pause for a minute because we have some announcements to do, and then we're going to come back with the second part of this podcast.
Yeah, we'll be back soon after the break to enhance our discussion and some justice to it. Keep tuned. Welcome back to this week's Transformative Talk. We are Blanca, Bruna, and Laura, your hosts for this episode of Transformative Talk. Before the break, we discussed the role of culture in academic performance. Now, we talk about why we need justice for a just education.
We have here a quote that we would like to invite here for the conversation. It said, more recently, Bartolomé, 1994, has decried the search for the right teaching strategies and argued for a humanizing pedagogy that respects and uses the reality, history, and perspective of the students as an integral part of educational practice. What do you think about this? Humanizing pedagogy.
Well, I think relating to justice, this reminds me of a talk that the same author we were discussing before, Letson Billings, she gave recently, talking about what is justice and what we are talking when we talk about social justice in education and justice in education. And I believe that all in all, it is very much related to humanizing pedagogy. When we are talking about justice, we are talking about recognizing human beings and their differences, nuances, culture as well, and that justice might represent something completely different for different people.
Yeah, we have here one of the letters that we received. It's saying, Eurocentric curriculum and instruction do not support the development of marginalized children. It reinforces the deficit thinking model about them. Humanizing pedagogy and knowledge constructions are imperative for culturally relevant, responsive, and sustaining pedagogies and practices. So here we need to reflect about, if we're thinking about justice in education, we really need to take into account another perspectives, not just Eurocentric curriculum or Eurocentric knowledge.
A lot of times our students don't see themselves reflected or valued because of the curriculum that we impose on them. For example, as a dual language teacher, I have a lot of experience working with students from other countries, and I put myself in their shoes. And sometimes the language differences, the differences in even just the way our schools are structured with our scheduling, and even the way they sit might be night and day different from where they come from. And I think as educators, humanizing them and realizing that what they have or bring with them is a value, and then doing our best to incorporate it into what we do in the classroom, it'll go a long way towards making them feel welcome And just having them buy into their education too, like having them want to be successful for themselves when they realize that it's something that's attainable.
I
would like to ask Blanca, in your experience, do you think that offering a dual-lingual, bilingual education is a matter of justice?
I think it is. If we look at our history, even just here in the United States, a lot of times just our language was taken away from us in the sense that we were not allowed to speak our language at schools. Students were even punished for speaking their language. And your language is a huge part of your culture. It's a huge part of who you are. So when you're not able to speak, let alone learn, let alone use it, and be shown that to be successful is to be bilingual and that your language is, you're being additive, we're going to add to that, not take away, is very important. That applies to just culture in general too. And let's add to it. We're not ever trying to take away from it. So that deficit thinking, and switching it to an additive is important when we're humanizing our students.
Yeah. And big part of that is really let our students know that what they have and their origins had value, that it's something really that is going to add a lot of value and reflection and richness to the classrooms in which they are part of.
Mm-hmm. We never want to be part of the oppressors, obviously, as educators, because we hold so much power in the classroom. I remember when I was little growing up in a setting where I was pushed out of there was no dual language program available. The purpose of my education was for me to learn English, not to be bilingual. But being told that's not how you say it, you need to learn English, and being corrected for just speaking my language. It's not a good feeling. And it's obviously not something that we want to do or impose on our students either. We just need to show our students that they're valued. And that includes language. That includes knowledge from their parents. That includes knowledge from their community. That includes everything that makes them them.
Mm, wow. Powerful
yeah, here words. We have the idea of another, as Bruna was saying before, this is a person that works at teaching teachers to be more welcoming, compassionate, and more culturally relevant. And she said, students have to feel like they had value and bring value. Society often doesn't that or do that for them. So educators need to counter that in their classrooms to fully teach the child. Students can be so much more engaged and hopeful when they know what value they bring to the classroom and to the world.
Yes,
what are
absolutely.
You? Yes.
So as Blanca was saying, when you are allowed to say the least, speak your own language and understand that you have value as a human being, we are talking about justice. We are talking about a just education. All in all, as the, you know, the title of our podcast today, it's not, when we talk about education, it's not just performance, academic performance. We are talking about social inequities as well. We're talking about social political consciousness and justice and being valued and understanding what you can bring to the table just by being yourself. This is powerful. This is great. If we have the opportunity to actually recognize ourselves, like every minoritized community, as individuals and human beings that have value and that have something to contribute, this is very, very powerful work.
Exactly.
And this has its fundamentals in science. Sociolinguistics had suggested that if the student's home language is incorporated into the classroom, students are more likely to be academic, to have academic success.
There's a lot of right now, even in social media, a lot of this, I don't know if you ladies have heard of it, but the no sabo kids, the kids who are kind of ridiculed for not knowing English well enough, but also not knowing Spanish well enough. What we need to understand is that these students know two languages. The level that they know it, it's not what should be questioned here. They should be respected and valued for what they do know. But even in the classrooms, when teachers correct students and say, that's not the correct way of saying it, that's how they say it at home. That's how they say it in their surroundings. So we need to not oppress our students by saying things like that. We could just switch our mindset and say something like, wow, that's how you say it at home. This is how we say it in an academic setting. This is how we add to what they bring. Never make them feel like we're taking away or like what they know or their knowledge or their experiences are not as good as the mainstream expectations. I think that's very important.
Yeah, absolutely. The first time I read about translanguaging, mm-hmm. I was over the moon because mm-hmm. I realized I do that all the time, not with you guys, but my notes, my class notes, they are this completely different language, this mixture between Brazilian Portuguese and American English. And that's it. That's how I roll. And it makes perfect sense to me.
We have a letter from an educator, and she's sharing her experience when she was in school. It said, when I attended school, I was the only person who spoke my language there from K to 12. My younger sister and cousin all attended a Montessori school for the first 3 to 4 years, and literally all teachers spoke our native language. At first, I really wondered, did that make a difference? I guess they learned the content all better because they all up skipping one grade. Here, something interesting for me is that they were attending a Montessori school. This is a private school. And sometimes the people that had access to Montessori school, they receive better education because this kind of school, they're really thinking about the culture of their students. So with you cannot have access to a private school or to this kind of alternative pedagogies, maybe you're not going to receive this kind of honor of this kind of value from your own culture.
Well, that makes me think even in our education system here in the United States, we have dual language programs, which are amazing, and they have proven to work for students who speak English and Spanish. But I always wonder, what if our students from the Middle East who speak Pashto? Mm-hmm. What if our students that speak different dialects that are not supported? They have to go into a school system where they are taught in English most of the day, and they get pulled out by an ESL teacher who might not even speak their native language, but who is trying to do strategies to help them comprehend the English language. So their native language is never really supported. And it makes me think of this experience of this person who was the only person her whole education who spoke language. So that was never something they could build on or add on. So we also have to think of our students who don't have the same opportunities as students that are enrolled in dual language programs. What can we do as educators to all try to be inclusive and try to build on what they bring to the plate? Because like you said, not everybody has the same experiences or the same opportunities for educational experiences.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that we might sometimes think, oh, but you know, people can just go online, and today we have all the information needed online. We can just learn there. But the reality is not that. So mm-hmm. there is this amazing institution and organized group called Whose Knowledge, and they kind of try to map what is the dominant knowledge, what's going on out there. And they've recently partnered up to launch this report, the State of the Internet Languages report this year, at the beginning of the year. And the numbers are intriguing, to say the least. So we have more than 7,000 languages in the world. More than 4,000 of them are actually written languages. However, the majority of the content that we have online, they are available only in 10 languages. Mm-hmm. And those 10 languages, they are colonizers' language. So we have the majority of the content online in English, Spanish, Portuguese, German, and so on. The problem with that is that minoritized communities, they are not being able to speak their language in school, but they are also consuming content online in someone else's language. Mm-hmm. So even if they wanted, I'll just go online and find this out. They are obliged to do that in English or in another language, that is the language of the colonizers. So, of course, we were talking about Latinx communities, but if we look at other way around, but you do speak Spanish because of, you know, Spain. And we had different languages before, the same with Brazil. So we speak Portuguese because of Portugal actually colonized us. But we had thousands of indigenous languages that vanished pretty much because no one's allowed to speak that language or interact with the world using that language. And when it comes to education, we should be preoccupied with that.
Yeah, I think we've come a long way for Spanish speakers, but there's still a lot of work to do for all of the other languages.
Yeah, but the good thing is that we had hope. Mm-hmm. So let's allow Gloria Laxon Billings to teach us. What do we need to do? What are culturally relevant teachers doing to support learners from different cultures? So she said that culturally relevant teachers utilize the students' culture as a vehicle for learning, involve parents in the classroom, and reinforce that parents were or are a knowledgeable and capable resource. And children and families, they learn that they and their origins had value. So if we start implementing this in our classrooms and in our work as our researchers, we have hope.
Definitely. I think we need to also get this information out to as many people as possible. I don't think that all educators know this great information that's available because it's more than just good teaching. It is good teaching. If you do these things, if you are culturally conscious, if you strive to teach your students to want to achieve academically, but also that social justice piece, then we're going to create our next generations to come will definitely be on a better footing than we are right now.
Yeah. Blanca, you received the last letter from today. Would you like to read it?
Yes. When students see their culture and experiences invited into the classroom, they are invested in what they are learning and their academic achievement. However, I feel that too many educators believe this can be achieved simply by picking out a read aloud with brown characters. No. While this contributes to having an inviting classroom culture in which all students' experiences and identities are valued, this would not be enough. I personally do this by also taking the time to get to know parents. I have invited parents to be an expert in the classroom. Nowadays with COVID, it can get a bit more tricky. Parents also have to fill out background checks, but I have seen the benefits. Students' eyes light up when they realize their parents, friends, or community members are experts, that their knowledge is worth learning and sharing. It is a bit more work for teachers, but it is not too crazy. We can encourage parents to be knowledgeable about others in our lessons. We would just have to get to know them and ask when it is appropriate.
Thank you. Yeah.
So we are talking about justice in education, and justice is related to being able to speak your language, to know that your community, your heritage, your knowledge is valued in school, and that your people are valued in school. Because sometimes we see that just the culture is valued a little bit, like this is trendy. So this can come to class, but not your people, just your thing, you know, just a song, your, you know, music style or your dance style. Let's talk about samba again, but not your people. So for a just education, we would need to get to know the community. I mean, is it too crazy? So how can we do that?
I think we just need to be open to communicate with anybody who's willing to communicate with us, whether that's parents or whether that's the business around the corner or whether that's someone who comes and picks up kids or someone who knows someone in the community. Like I said, it could be viewed, and we've talked about this previously, it could be viewed as more work for teachers because they have to go out of their way to do this, but it's doable. We have these conversations with parents anyways. We hold conferences. We have open houses. We invite them into our schools. Why not invite them into our classrooms?
Yeah, I think we as a researchers as well, we need to take into account communities and invite them, not just for an interview, but to co-author this knowledge, because this is knowledge that we were producing with communities. It's not the authorship of a scholar.
Exactly.
Well, I think our time is almost up. I'd like to add two more quotes from Ladson Billings for us to briefly talk about. So Ladson Billings says that culturally relevant teaching does not imply that it's enough for students to choose academic excellence and remain culturally grounded if those skills and abilities represent only an individual achievement. Beyond those individual characteristics of academic achievement and cultural competence, students must develop a broader social-political consciousness that allows them to critique the cultural norms, values, mores, and institutions that produce and maintain social inequities.
We have to remember that we're teaching tomorrow's leaders, and we want to teach them to be critical.
Yeah.
And if we want to teach the whole child, that is definitely a very important component of our work as educators.
There is no justice without consciousness.
There is no justice without consciousness. I think that's it.
So thank you. Thank you for this moment of reflection and conversation with good friends and with our special audience.
To learn more about the topics we just discussed in this podcast, we recommend the two readings and the talk we were talking about, Steering Dr. Ledson Billings. The first one is a 1994 paper entitled Budget, That's Just Good Teaching, The Case for Culturally Relevant Pedagogy. The second one, a 2014 paper, in which Ledson Billings update her theories called Culturally Relevant Pedagogy 2.0, aka The Remix. And last but not least, we recommend her talk, Justice Matters, Reclaiming a Fundamental Right, given to the University of Georgia Mary Frances Early College of Education, available on YouTube. And that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening. And remember, if you want to support what we do, then share, subscribe, and leave a review where you discovered our show. That's all for now, but I'll see you in the next episode of Transformative Talk. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.